We're doing Parshat Chayei Sarah. Sarah lives to the ripe old age of 127 and passes away. It's unclear why she's out in Hebron. Avram eulogizes her, comes to bury her. He wants Maris HaMachpelah. This man named Ephron owns it. And then there's this whole discussion about will he sell it, won't he sell it, at what price will he sell it, when will Avram pay? Avram insists on paying up front. And Avram wants to make it into a family burial plot. The Hittites have an issue with that. And finally, they come to an agreement. And Avram wants a shidduch for his son. And he takes his trusted servant and sends him out with the promise that he won't bring Yitzchak out there, but rather bring him a wife from his family for Yitzchak. And so the servant takes 10 camels, goes out there, and he does a trick. He says, God help me out. If I want a sign that it's the right girl, the girl that I ask for a drink and offers me and my camels, that's the one that's fit for Yitzchak. So he didn't even finish talking, and Yitzchak and Rivka comes out, and she is from Avram's family, and she's very good looking, and she has never been violated, and she comes to draw her water, and he runs towards her and says, could you give me a drink from your pitcher? And she says, here, my master, drink. And she gives him to drink. And when she finishes giving him to drink, she says, I'll give the camels to drink too till they've drank their full. And then she quickly pours out the remaining water and runs and refills her pitcher. And she gives all his camels to drink. And he's standing there in silence, waiting to know if God made him successful or not when they finished drinking. So then he takes a nose ring and bracelets, and they're all made of gold, and he gives them to her and asks her, whose daughter are you? Shouldn't he have asked that first? Is there room in your father's house to sleep? So she has gold dangling from her, and she says, I'm the daughter of Besuel from Milcah, from Nochar, and there's plenty of hay by us and place for you to sleep. So he bows and thanks Hashem and blesses Hashem, and she runs home and tells everyone what's going on. And she has a brother named Lavan. He sees all the gifts, and he hears the man say he's come from Avram's family. So he runs out and he says, come, blessed one who's blessed by Hashem, why should you stand outside? I cleared the house of all the idols. I made room for your camels. So he comes home and he undoes the camels and he gives them to eat. And then they wash their feet, and he's given to eat, and he says, I'm not eating till I tell you what's going on. And he tells them, I'm Avram's servant, my master was blessed, his wife had only one child, as an old woman she had the son Yitzchak, and he made me promise that I won't bring him a wife from anyone other than his own family, and I came here and I asked God for a sign, and your daughter lived up to the sign, and so I gave her the gifts, and now if you want to marry into the family, good. And if not, I'm going to go on my way. So the son speaks before the father and says, look, God obviously arranged this whole thing. We can't say anything. You could take Rivka, go ahead, and she should be your master's wife. And then he thanks Hashem, and he takes out all the silver and gold vessels and clothing, and he gives Rebecca, and he gives all kinds of gifts to her brother and her mother, and they eat. And the next morning he says, okay, time to go. And they say, wait, let her stick around and get ready. And he says, no, no, no. God gave me success. Don't detain me. And they say, no, let's ask the girl. So they ask her, are you going to go with this man? She says, I'll go. So they send her, and they bless her. And she goes with her girls, and they come to Yitzchak. And Yitzchak marries her, and he loves her. And then Avram remarries Keturah, which our tradition is that she was the same Hagar, and has many children from her. He has the child named Midian, which is going to father the Midianite people. He has a bunch of children, and he gives them gifts and sends them off, so that it's clear that Yitzchak is the continuation. And at the end of the parasha, we see the children of Yishmael, what his future was, and that brings us to the conclusion of the parasha where Yishmael passes away. Now let's see more what's going on here.
Everything in Torah is a lesson for us. So I was just wondering, this year especially, the story of Rivka, he's wondering, the woman that's going to give me the drink and my camels, I wonder, what's going on? I mean, is that a lesson for women to work like a slave? Come on, I mean, but she's a woman, she's not as strong as a man. Why should she work so hard to feed all those camels and they drink so much? And, she was nice enough to give him a drink, you know, and, but a woman's not as strong, yeah, I'm sorry, but women are not as strong as men.
Well, so she would be 3 years old.
So, like, I don't understand, what is he teaching us? Yeah, but come on, she's a little girl. She's a woman. Why should she be schlepping for camels? Like, I understand she'd be kind, but that's like, wow. Like, why is he expecting that for a wife? That's a very big thing. High expectations.
Right.
But he had the expectation that she would give his camels drink or just himself drink.
Because there are certain things that women do and there are certain things that women do back then. Like water drawing was okay for women to do because it's considered not as hard as doing other things, but she did go beyond in the fact that she voluntarily went out and fed the camels. And he didn't even ask for that sign that she would feed the camels. He asked for a sign, oh, she'll give me water, but she went above and beyond and she did the camel thing.
Well, he said his condition for the sign was to also feed the camels.
The woman that says also, I just find it hard to understand. I'm not a feminist or anything, but like, come on, she's a girl, for heaven's sakes, you know?
Okay, so we'll get there. So Avram over here is showing great care for the deceased body of Sarah. And we have a rule in Torah and in Halacha that the care you show to the deceased is a reflection of the value you give life. Because if the human being is something unique, then when the human being passes away, you don't sit down and make a meal of him. You don't take his hides and make carpets of them, which is what they used to do in those days. You don't burn the body. On the contrary, you do something to show the value of the human being and that the body housed something special called a soul. And the whole idea of human dignity in halacha stems from the laws of the importance of burying a body. When the halacha demands that for a meis mitzvah, you're walking along the path, and you see a man who obviously has overdosed, a man who stinks, a man who has gin in his pocket up here, a man who has a filthy magazine coming out of his pocket down there, a man who you wouldn't want to stand next to in the subway, but you see the body in the floor, you have to realize there was godliness in that body and treat that body with dignity. And even if you're the Kohen Gadol on the eve of Yom Kippur and it means that you were about to do the holiest task, the halacha demands you go and deal with that body first. And from there we learn the concept of human dignity. So the halacha requires that we treat a human body that passes with tremendous respect, and from there we gain the perspective of the respect we're supposed to have for a human being in general. So, when Sarah passes, the Hittites, well, they're accustomed to just burying a person anywhere. And Avram comes and teaches them a concept. No, I want a respectful burial plot for Sarah. Now, within this concept is also the idea of Tichias HaMeisim, that to our minds, things aren't over when the body passes from the world. The soul has left the body. The body will decompose. But we anticipate that there is still a future. It's not all over. And as such, we treat the body differently. We bury it. And there's a point in investing something in that long-term future of burying the body respectfully. And once you're attuned to that idea, then there's also the idea where the soul is going to be judged. There's the idea of retribution. There's the idea of a judge and a jury waiting for us after our lives. So the stand in which Avram is facing off against the Hittites and insisting, I have to bury her, I have to make an honorable burial plot, I have to purchase the land to ensure that he doesn't change his mind one day and plow over her burial plot and just destroy it, that stand is not only out of respect for Sarah, but it is a stand in which Avram is insisting on part of Jewish theology. He is insisting on it. This is a part of life. There is an afterlife. There is a future. It doesn't end with the passing of the human being. So Avram comes and he's weeping over Sarah. And people are less inclined to weep over someone older who passes away. It's like, okay, they lived a nice life, and that's nature taking its course, and that's why we eulogize. Avram eulogizes her before he allows himself to weep, because the eulogy reminds us, okay, there was someone precious here, and we make a note of his passing. I like to compare it to whacking a cockroach as you're eating lunch. You whack the cockroach and you keep eating lunch, right? Well, a human being can't be like a cockroach. Or he drops dead, but we keep eating lunch. Even when the court is obligated to execute someone, the halacha says they may not eat for the remainder of that day. They have to fast the remainder of that day. But he was so wicked. He had two witnesses who warned him not to do it, and he still did it. And they warned him he would get the death penalty, and he still did it. And even so, the halacha says the court may not eat for the remainder of the day. So when you kill a cockroach, you can keep eating lunch. But when a human being passes away, you have to stop and say something happened here. So Avram eulogizes her and weeps over her. And then he comes to talk to the Hittites. And this is one of the great challenges in life where a person has to deal. Ordinarily, when catastrophe strikes, what a person wants to do is bury his head in the weeping and the sorrow. And the Torah demands no deal. Not only do you have to deal, but the Torah absolves a person of their other obligations. So when a person is an onan, when they have a relative who has passed, the Torah says you don't have to make any blessings. You don't pray. You don't put on tefillin. You don't do any mitzvah, because that's what's called me'al p'nei meso. We derive from Avram that so long as you have the responsibility of bringing that person to burial, that's considered as though the body is standing here right in front of you. You may not deal with anything else. You have to deal with that. That's your mitzvah. And everything else falls by the wayside. Obviously, not everything else doesn't mean you could murder and steal and do a billion things because you say, I have no more mitzvahs. No. It means the proactive mitzvahs that would take of your time, you are absolved from those in order to deal with this mitzvah. And Avram deals with the Hittites, and we learn a lot from Avram's dealings with them. Number one, they make him a promise, and he insists on having it in writing. Number two, they demand top dollar, and he pays it. Number three, he insists on paying before taking his end to ensure the deal is completely finalized. And Avram leaves the contract over the deed. He leaves it to his children and grandchildren. And the Jewish people, up to the time when they buried the last of Yaakov Avinu, they still had the deed from Avram Avinu. So Yaakov's children, the 12 tribes, had the deed to the Maaseh Machpelah. And he ensures that everyone sees very clearly that the deal was cut. You guys will come to junctures in your life where you have to rent an apartment. And you will find that the landlord makes all kinds of promises before you sign the contract. Put it all in writing. You tell him, you know, there's a broken screen over there. He says, no problem, I'll fix it. Write it in the contract. You tell him, there's a very weak current coming out of the sink. Can you up the water pressure? Sure, no problem, I'll deal with that. Write it in the contract. People are very nice and sweet before you sign the contract. You have to make sure everything's in the contract up front and clear. And that's what Avram Avinu does. Everything's there. I want it for a continued burial plot, for me and my descendants. I want the field. I want the cave. He makes everything clear. Why is he so interested in this cave? Well, when the three angels came in last week's parasha, so one of the sheep he wanted for them ran away, and he ran after the sheep until that sheep led him into the cave. He walked into the cave, and he saw a lamp burning and a man lying there next to his wife, and it was Adam and Eve. No one knew where Adam and Eve were buried. Adam and Eve purposely ran away from humanity when their time came to pass from the world to ensure that people wouldn't make them into idols. They were concerned that people would say, he was created by God, he must have all kinds of powers, so they'd make their burial place as a shrine, and people would bury to him, or people would say, if you touch him, you get healed. And it seems there were certain powers that were associated with Adam. He did have exceptional powers. He did have something exceptional to him. You see, his body didn't rot. He was created by God. So Adam and Eve were exceptional, but it was pivotal to them that humanity not make them into an idol. And so they went to this special cave, which is a cave within a cave called the Maras HaMachpelah, the double cave. And they, when their time to pass came, they each laid down over there, one next to the other, and they passed away. And that's how we do till today. We bury a woman next to her husband. There are halachos about this. What happens when he has a second wife? What happens when the wife tells her kids, psst, when I die, put me next to my dad, not next to him? The halacha discusses all these scenarios because we have traditions exactly how it's supposed to play itself out. So when Avraham walks in and he smells the Garden of Eden and he sees an exceptional smell and he sees an exceptional burial plot and he sees an exceptional lamp lit over there and next to Adam and Eve, so from that day onward he wants that spot. And when the time comes, he makes the bid with Ephron. After he purchases it, only afterward does he bury Sarah. They try to persuade him and say, bury her, we'll make the dealings later. Why should you have trouble now? You're going to find that people very often say they're doing it for you. Why should we deal with this now? Don't worry about it. And I say, no, deal with it now. Get it all clear and all in writing. And even though people will always say they're doing it for your sake, you have to have it clear like Avraham Avinu. Avraham has everything, but he has a son who's not married. How old is Yitzhak at this juncture? Well, let's see. If when he was born, Sarah was 90, and now she's 127, so Yitzhak is 37 years old. What an old bachelor. So our sages say he needed a very long vacation after the Akedah. He wasn't ready to deal with life after the Akedah. He had to recover. And our sages say different opinions as to where he went to recover. But whatever age you're going to say the Akedah took place, you could say it happened when he was 37, but you could also say it happened when he was a kid, which seems to be the easier understanding of the parasha. Our tradition is he was a mature young man or a mature older man. But however you take it, he needed time to recover. And now Avram is taking care of the shidduch for him, which is an interesting thing in its own right. So how do you look for a shidduch? So Avram looks for someone from his own hometown. And our sages say that's the way to go. When possible, try to find someone from your hometown, even from the same town, not only the same city or the same country, because you'll be used to the same norms. In ancient times, and today, even today, if you go to certain areas of the world, so then you go to certain communities and everyone has the same schedule. In Greece, you have whole islands where everyone gets up at the same time. There's a schedule that everyone abides by. And if you're going to marry someone from a similar background, that helps. I know there's a couple I know who comes from one type of Sephardi family where all the women in the family get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. They go to sleep at like 8, 9 o'clock at night and they get up at 4. So by 6 o'clock, they've cleaned up the whole house. They've already mopped the house down twice. They've done all their laundry. And they sit down for their cup of coffee after davening shachris at 6 o'clock in the morning. So he told me how his mother is capable of coming over to their house at 6:30 Shabbos morning. Everyone's still sleeping. She's finished davening. She said her tehillim for the day. She's like, she's had half a day already. And at 6:30 Shabbos morning, she's knocking at the door and she's looking at them like, what's wrong with you guys? You guys are just getting up now? So there, you understand the culture difference is a problem. She's capable of calling them at 6 o'clock in the morning. And her daughter-in-law groggily answers the phone and she's like, hello? Are you taking your nap already? It's like, and the daughter-in-law is like, no. when we come from different backgrounds, it gets in the way. That doesn't mean it's not doable. I know many Americans who married Yemenites and they managed. But marriage is hard enough when you come from the same background. Chazal said, it's preferable not to add that hardship. And that's especially an important idea for you guys. Very often Americans that come to Israel get taken by all kinds of things. The Israeli spunk, the Sephardi genteel, the Moroccan spice. There's different girls can have different attractions when you're a foreigner. But you have to realize that the attractions you might see now, the hardships you don't realize yet. In Moroccan culture, it's very accepted that a woman yells at the top of her lungs, and that's part of being feminine. And a docile American from Alabama sits there and looks at his wife and is like, what happened? And she's yelling at the top of her lungs. You insult me. You have zero respect for me. You don't treat me like a human being. Next to you, I feel like I should have married a rhinoceros. I don't understand. How do you feel human? You're a subhuman piece of whatever. And he's looking at her like, what did I do? I stepped on the floor after you washed it and I didn't notice. You know, what are you getting all ramped up about? And from her culture, that's part of being feminine. From his culture, you know, if you'd kill her mother, maybe that would warrant such a reaction. Okay, you understand they're not going to talk the same language. And you have many Sephardi or Yemenite women who take it for granted that for the first few years of marriage, they spend much of the time by their mother. If you're not coming from that culture, so then you're wondering, didn't we get married to move into our own house? How come you want to eat supper every other night or every night by your mother? We had a couple from Machon Meir that after the marriage, they're married 3 months, and he asks his wife, are we ever going to eat supper alone? She says, don't you think that's expensive? We have an open invitation by our parents. Like, why do you want to eat supper alone? So where she's coming from, that's the norm. You got married. My parents take care of you. Why do I have to slave over the oven? That's part of being a good mother. The first few months, we eat by my parents. And he's looking at her and saying, we got married to be together. And she's like, right. We're together after supper, we're together before supper, you know. Okay, now you can't say one is right and one is wrong. It's culture. This is where she comes from. This is where he comes from. And these are things which you won't necessarily see on a date. And that's why Chazal said, when possible, it's recommended that one should prefer someone that comes from your own hometown, not even your own country. As close as you can get, it helps. Does that mean you cannot marry someone Yemenite? No. I've seen many beautiful marriages between Moroccans and Yemenites and Americans and South Africans and Canadians. And at the end of the day, you can make it work, but it's an added difficulty. Yeah?
I came here very apprehensive of, because as a kind of Moroccan attitude, you described as something I thought I'd kind of Moroccan. And people always like, well, I find this attractive because, you know, it's interesting, it makes it interesting, and, you know, who wants a girl that, you know, is not like that? Me, I've always been, like different, and I've always wondered if there's something to whether it's wrong or right or in the middle or what are they to say about a woman like this. Someone who's very gentle, you know, just like, I like girls who are, like, very gentle, very, like, you know, very understanding as opposed to shouting at the top of their lungs all the time.
Right, but part of certain cultures is that when you're dating, you're the epitome of genteel. When you're married, you have to be feminine too. So it's not something you'll necessarily know in advance. Yeah, you marry. Moroccans are notorious for washing the house 4 times before breakfast. You're going to wonder, you know, didn't you just wash it a half hour ago? And your wife is going to look at you and say, yeah, but you stepped all over it. And you're going to say, yeah, but I waited till it dried. And she's going to say, so you think your shoes are spick and span? Like, why? You're coming from different places, and you can't say one is right and one is wrong. And you could make it work. But you have to realize that there are going to be certain areas where you have to make it work. Even on small things, what do you eat before a fast? So certain Sephardi cultures have this huge meal where you stuff as much meat as you can into your system. And then people keel over on Yom Kippur because they're after this huge meal where you could barely walk to shul. And it's not a meal which you would choose with starches and salts and vegetables. And no, this is their tradition. Now go make it work. I'll give you a small example. You know, mikveh night. So the couple hasn't been together for a long time. So ordinarily, in many cultures, you assume that you have a nice supper together and then the couple has time together. Certain cultures have a custom that part of her showing how she's coming back and she's happy to be with her husband is that she makes a 10-course meal. Now, it's the summer. She gets home at 10 o'clock at night. and she has to be a good wife. So now she goes and starts putting up the stove. Now supper is going to start at 12 o'clock. I have work tomorrow, but I have to be a good wife. There are certain places in Syria where the custom is that a husband may not set foot in the kitchen. If you set foot in the kitchen, that's the equivalent of you telling her that she's a bad wife. So now, I know of a guy, an American, who married such a woman, and he says, it's fantastic until you wake up thirsty in the middle of the night. You want to go and get yourself a cup of water. If she will catch that plastic cup in the wastebasket the next morning, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. So I'm not a good wife after all. I'm not good enough for you, right? Right? I know what you're thinking. Go explain that. I couldn't make this up if I wanted to. The guy told me. He says to me, it took me years to learn how to cover my tracks. Okay, but that's the culture she comes from. The culture she comes from, if you didn't wake me up in the middle of the night, then obviously I'm not a good enough wife. Now she's spending the whole day being very upset at you. What did I do to deserve this? Couldn't you have just woken me for a minute? I don't understand you. Go explain that. So, one guy says, it's great. I never said, you try to clear the table and she's looking at you like, what's wrong with you? What did I do? Was the food not good enough? Okay, different cultures. That you can't say right or wrong. But you have to realize that there is a benefit to finding someone from your culture. You can make it work. I'm not saying stay bound to this. But that's what Avraham's looking for. And not only that, then there's the question of midot. The main thing we're looking for when we're looking for a girl is what type of human being is she? Her brilliance and her philosophies, that's something that's adaptable. You'll talk, you'll find common ground. But when it comes to her midot, what type of human being she is, that's really harder to change. We come with our baggage, we come with our norms. So Avram knows that his family takes in guests, as we see, even Lavan and Besuel, they take in guests, and he knows that they're into helping other people, they're kind people, and that's what he's looking for. He doesn't tell the servant, find me a monotheist. Why not? Because that wasn't critical to him. Philosophy is something we can discuss. Philosophy is more easy to adapt. When it comes to what type of human being you are, that's much harder. And that's why he tells him, you have to find someone from my family, because, and that's what Eliezer, what does the servant do? He wants to see how caring is the person. When I started dating, I asked, I didn't ask, my mother told me, what I have to look for is the formula that Eliezer was looking for. A woman who says, Gam ligma lecha ashke. I'm not only going to do what you asked for, I'm not only going to help you, I'm going to take a step beyond that. And in answer to your question, David, think about what it took to be Eliezer's wife. You're running a hotel, a non-profit soup kitchen. Look at what happens. Avram is 3 days after his circumcision. Yitzchak's wife, to be a wife in Avram's house. Look, 3 days after the circumcision, undoubtedly his wife is taking care of his bandages and helping him out, and there's what to be done in the house. And yet he sees three strangers walking in the heat of the day. Guess what? They didn't have air conditioning. So the heat of the day in the tent wasn't too pleasant. And what does Avram do? He runs into the tent and says, Sarah, quick, put up a cake. What, quick, put up a cake? In this heat, I'm supposed to put up a cake? In order to function in this house, you had to be willing to be dedicated to humanity, even when it's tough. If my question is, why didn't he do it for himself? Then I'm never going to help. If my question is, how can I be of help? Then I can be a member of Avram's household. Avram invites the guests, and Avram dedicates himself to humanity, and the central question and the central theme in his life is, how can I be of help? What can I do to be a positive force in humanity? And in order to be a woman in Avram Avinu's house, that has to be the guiding question. If the question is, does he deserve it? If the question is, why should I be doing that? He should be doing that. Well, then she's not the wife.
So you're looking for the elite, like this Navy SEAL. You're looking for the best of the best.
Well, that's what we have here. Who is Avram and Yitzchak? These are people who spend their lives dedicated to humanity. So yes, that's what life in Avram Avinu's house is all about. Being dedicated to humanity. And so yes, in order to be a Rebecca, you had to be tough. And she is.
When Eli- is that something we should learn from? Because that's not kind of
yes.
The woman yes. should learn from that.
Every person should learn from it. The hallmarks of being a Jew are supposed to be a giving and caring person. And giving is about thinking, what can I do for you? Not do you deserve it.
But that's a little bit even further. That's like mom is schlepping and sweating.
Right.
And for the camels. And-
right. Right. And, I, and let's take it a step further. Eliezer walks in and they set up a meal and he says, 1 second, the camels are hungry. And he feeds the camels before he eats. And not only Eliezer, but that's the halacha for us too. The Torah says we say it in Kriya Shema every day. I will give food for your animals and for you. And from there we derive halacha. You may not sit down for a meal when your animals outside are hungry. You have to feed them and only then come home to eat. So you're supposed to have that care, that sensitivity. And that's what we see in our parsha with Eliezer as well. What is the first thing that Eliezer says? I'm Avram's servant. We tend to work the other way. If we have a problem, we like to mention that last. I have a friend who's missing an arm. He has a prosthetic, he doesn't have an arm. So when I tried setting him up in the beginning, so I'd say what a great guy he was and say everything good about him. And at the end I'd say, but you know, he has a prosthetic arm. He's very talented and he accomplishes a lot, but he's missing an arm. And I didn't succeed too much. Then the wife of another friend of mine told me how she sets him up. She says, when I call to set him up, I call a girl and I say, I'm calling to set you up with a guy who's missing an arm. That's how I start. And now you're going to ask yourself, why am I doing such a thing? So let me tell you what's great about him, why I'm doing such a thing. Why I think that you're such a great girl, that this guy is a great guy for you. But she starts with the problem. And she succeeded in setting him up. More than one girl wanted to marry him. You know, he is a great guy. He is an exceptional human being. So we learn from Eliezer that when you have a problem, put it out front. Don't hide it. We're out of time. Okay, you can listen to last year's class, and if you guys want, we can figure out